Hey, Startup Hustle listeners, before we get into today's episode, I've got some exciting news to share. If you've enjoyed the insights and stories here at Startup Hustle, you're going to love what we have in store at our brand new podcast called Product Driven. I've always described myself as a product guy first, entrepreneur, software engineer, but really a product guy. I love building products. Many people struggle, though, with how to take a product idea and build a tech product, while software engineers struggle to understand the business side of things and they just don't see the big picture. My new podcast, Product Driven, is about that gap between business and the tech side of building software. It's designed for startup founders, tech leaders, software engineers, and anyone who loves tech and startups. Thank you for being part of this community. Enjoy this episode of Startup Hustle, and please subscribe to Product Driven in your podcast app, and you can also check it out on YouTube. Thank you so much.
And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle, a podcast for entrepreneurs by entrepreneurs. If you want to start, own, or build a business, then you're in the right place. We bring you the real truth about what it's like to take something from concept to launch. From growth, innovation, experience, failing, or winning big, we've got you covered. So let's get down to business with another episode of Startup Hustle, brought to you by Fullscale.io.
And we're back for another episode of the Startup Hustle. This is your host, Matt Watson. Today, I'm joined by Alex Polykov. He is the CEO and founder of Project Simple. We're going to be talking about how to manage software projects today, which are never easy to do. And most software projects, you know, kind of go off the rails, take longer than you think, all the problems. So hopefully he can give us some great tips today about how to manage software projects. I know I could always use some more tips. I do want to remind everybody before we get started, today's sponsor is Fullscale, which is my company. If you need to hire a software development team, we've got over 300 employees working for dozens of other companies, building all sorts of technology, different tech stacks. You can check us out at fullscale.io. Alex, welcome to the show, man.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me, Matt.
So I'm hoping that you have like some magic button, you know, holy grail solution to make managing software easier. Is that what you're going to tell us today?
I would hope to think so. However, it would be a little too arrogant to assume that one size fits all is what works for everybody. It really depends on the size of the team that people have. You know, managing projects is not easy, and the style and things you have to pay attention to really changes when you're a small team, let's say, you know, 3 to 10 people versus multiple teams, and then eventually an enterprise company with, you know, upwards of
hundreds. It's all totally different.
Yeah, so there is no real panacea, and everybody keeps on trying to find the right way of doing things. But it's not really about, coming up with anything new. It's about wrapping it into things that we know.
A lot of it's the fundamentals, right? At the end of the day, it's the fundamentals. You have to be good at the fundamentals.
Yeah, and if you think about it, like the leap of software engineering, I've been around doing engineering for about 25 years. So I can only think about the last 20 years. But in the last 20 years, the discipline really changed. You know, we had the waterfall, and then Agile came around. We changed things. And this is where then it evolved into DevOps-centric, metric-based development. And then eventually the product management became its own discipline. So there's been a lot of evolution since. And, I think with all of those things combined, it's hard to see the entire picture, especially because people today, they learn things in pieces and there's so much information, it's hard to put it all together.
Well, and it's hard to be a manager, you know, VP of engineering, a CTO, any kind of engineering leader, and also be an expert at all of those things. But that's the job, right? As an engineering leader, you have to understand all of those things, figure out how to manage a team, run a team, and accomplish all those things.
Yeah, but what about the conflicts, right? So there is a new product organization now, right? Previously, there were just business units, line of business, and they told you the business rules, and you have to implement software. So you really had only one person running the technology side. Now you have two. You have the product management side responsible for the product and the marketing, right? And anything usability, metrics, data, et cetera. And then you have the engineering side, which is the discipline of building things. And now they're colliding, because you have the so-called non-functional requirements, right? The architecture, the design, scalability things conflicting with a product-centric vision. We need more features so we could sell, sell, sell. And, you know, the conflict of these two roles is pretty significant. So I think that that also adds to the chaos.
It creates a healthy conflict, though, that a lot of people need, right? Because I feel like in a lot of companies, if the engineering team or the software development team is kind of in control of the roadmap, they like to work on like maintenance projects and technical debt and just rewriting stuff that works. And they just kind of get in this loop of like non-productivity, I feel like, at big corporations. Where if you have the product team that is really driving more of what's being worked on, I feel like in a lot of companies, they're going to work on things that are more productive.
Yes and no, right? So it, I guess the right answer here is it depends. So some organizations, they actually put product in the higher hierarchical position than engineering. In other organizations, they put engineering above the product. And in some of them, they're kind of like sister departments, if you will.
They're peers.
They're peers, but they serve different purposes and, you know, they bump heads a lot. And the reason I sometimes it's a healthy conflict, sometimes not so much. It's good to have different perspectives. However, it's important to realize when you're strong-arming somebody too hard. And yeah. This goes towards the whole culture, managing the culture of the organization. Because it's easy to push people into building features for sales and not giving engineering enough time to work on the technical debt.
It takes a healthy balance.
And vice versa. It's easy to get into refactoring because we want to build things and then stall the project for the next 6 months while the market is losing the opportunity to bring something to the end users and make money. So I think understanding those things is critical, and it's not easy. Anytime there's a partnership, that's what gets things very complicated.
Well, I feel like a lot of engineering teams struggle because of the product part of it, though. Like, they don't have the right requirements, they don't have the right like roadmap and direction of where we're trying to go. And I especially feel like that's a problem in bigger companies, because the product teams, I don't know how else to describe this, they sort of get neutered. They don't want to take any risk, they don't want to make any big changes, you know, so there's not a lot of innovation really going on, because nobody wants to take the risk to make the big changes that need to be made. Like, the company I sold 12 years ago, they haven't changed the product in 12 years because everybody is scared to change it. Like, even the icons are the same, the buttons are the same. Like, they're terrified to make the changes, you know, and I feel like so many corporations end up in that, like, that problem.
That's a good point. I think the problem is that the generic title of a product manager is hard to identify, right? If you think about product managers, sometimes, you know, anybody straight out of college that's being hired as to manage a product doesn't have enough experience, right? So it's going to be a struggle. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be a person that's very susceptible to stakeholders. Right? Because they're going to take orders. They don't know any better.
Yeah.
It's going to be somebody that really hasn't built stuff. So maybe book smart, but, you know, they need the experience to get some strong legs, you know, underneath of them. But then you have the opposite picture. You have somebody that's been in the industry for, let's say, 30 years and not aggressive enough to make changes. Right. So where do you find that balance of experienced people that can take the leadership, that can make bets on the way the markets are evolving and actually be trusted to make those leaps and bounds?
And leader,
and that's the hard part.
That starts with the leadership at the top, right? The leadership at the top has to build that culture to say, we're willing to make those changes and be that way and do that.
Yes. And the best part about it is you can actually test things now. You know, if the software cycles are small, you don't need to wait a year right? To produce something that you can take to market. You can do the same thing. Whenever I end up in a new environment, what I've actually done is I try to convince the leadership to have a startup within the enterprise.
Right. That's what we need.
Identify some budget. Get a small group of people. It does not need to be big. Just one team. One team to start making progress on something where you can place a bet. If you've burned 3 months worth of salaries for people to actually try to go after it to test something and it didn't play out, well, you're a big enterprise. You can probably take that. That's not a big deal, right? But if it does play out, and if you're getting customers, early customers on board, and if you treat it as a startup, then you can start adding people and growing to it and allocating more budget. The problem that we have is that most of the time, they try to use a traditional keep the lights on people to try to conquer new market opportunities. And that's where things
they're different personalities.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, tell us more about your company, Project Simple. It's projectsimple.ai. For those who are listening, check it out. It's a type of project management software, right? So tell us more about your company and why you decided to start a company in this space and how you guys are different.
Oh, God. Good question. So
you can say you were crazy. That's a valid answer.
Oh, well, that's I kind of everybody tells me I'm crazy because I've went into this space. When I tell people, hey, I have a better way of doing agile project management, they ask me, like, why would you even do that? There's hundreds of solutions. And I tell people this very same answer. So everybody who's in development knows a product called Jira. It's the biggest one on the market. It's been around for 20 years. You know, it used to be a godsend about 20 years ago, not so much anymore. But when you look at the field of alternatives, there's really not much out there. Everybody else is sort of a clone or tries to be a clone. A little bit better user experience, but not anything drastically different. Sort of, you know, you take a look at one, you take a look at the other. You can actually compare the features. They're almost identical. The problem is that it still doesn't solve the problems in development. The issues still exist. You know, why do we need to reconfigure all the teams to run their own independent development cycles when you have multiple teams on the same project? Can't we have a simple process of delivering the structure for development across the entire project? And that's sort of the problem we solve. But I started with this a little bit backwards. I was an engineer for about 25 years and went into startups. And I started to encounter problems with delivery. I'm selling things. Then I come back and tell teams, hey, listen, here's what we need to deliver, agile process and all. Then I come back to them and the teams are like, hey, Alex, we're not going to get this done. I go, whoa, why not? The answer I get usually is like, well, you know, it's going to take us longer. And my frustration was always in, why didn't you guys raise your hand earlier to tell me that you're running into potential issues or just flag the fact that we were at risk? And most of the time, people are afraid of saying that. And where I started Project Simple is building the AI that would alert me if we're going to slide off schedule.
Okay.
So that's kind of how we started. But then what happened is I needed the data. And I scanned a lot of the data from other project management tools. And I found that because all teams are exercising their development process differently, even for multi-team projects, it's hard to interpret the data so that it can be structured in a way to compare apples with apples and oranges with oranges. And to fix that, I needed to standardize the process. So this was kind of the solution to say, hey, if we're gonna generate the data and we're gonna create it ourselves by having our own tools, then why don't we fix all of the things that are wrong with solutions such as Jira or others? And we've been working on it for a few years now. We're getting excellent reviews. People are really surprised that you could really make things simple. And this is kind of where we are. And actually, the name came out of the feedback.
Yeah, I like the name.
As funny as it may be.
So you started out with, you mentioned trying to identify projects that are over schedule, right? Like, isn't that what you said earlier?
So we started out by trying to build the AI that would predict if somebody's running late.
Running behind schedule.
If you're not going to get things done by the deadline. And the fact that it's AI, it's not attached to any emotions. So the problem of reporting and raising hand of a flag, hey, we need help, just is no longer a challenge because there's no emotions attached to it. It's just a flag. Hey, maybe somebody needs to take a look at it. We might be sliding off schedule.
Well, I think everyone universally has this problem that projects don't get completed as fast as they want to. They always take longer than you expect. So how do you build that into your software to actually identify that that's happening?
So good question. We've developed a very unique prescriptive process to Agile, which actually follows the principles of flow, lean, and XP. So we do have the Scrum and Scrumban implementations, but altogether, the way that we follow that process makes it easy to see where the team is. And then also we decided that we were going to combine it so that we can foster one product backlog for multiple teams. And then by accident, actually, we saw that the picture of teams working and developing just started to flow into very easy projections of timelines and our ability to detect risks. And so it was a vision from the beginning, but it played out kind of with a unique process. Prescriptive is another word for limiting. So yes, we do not do configurations. We do not have the quote-unquote sales force of project management like Jira, but I think that's not necessary at all. So people use those things because they're trying to get something else done. So it's kind of, if you need a custom field, somebody's going to implement a custom field. But in development process, you actually don't need that. That's reporting, and it's totally different.
Yeah, I think that's one of the problems with Jira 15, 20 years ago when it first came out, is people definitely customized the hell out of it and, you know, made it super crazy complicated with workflows and custom fields and all of that, and really turned it into a nightmare. And maybe, I don't know about other companies, but I think over time we all realized like it doesn't have to be that complicated, or Jira just standardized more of the things. Like, to your point, like the process of how people do this these days is pretty standardized. Like, why would you add a bunch of junk you don't need? It's pretty well defined for 90% of people.
The other challenge is when you give people the ability to configure things, they will configure it in the way that's not intended.
Yeah.
Right?
For sure.
So people say, hey, we want to be agile, but then they would go ahead and implement some silly process that's not allowing people to change statuses.
Well, and that's...
Right?
And so that's part of your advantage too, where Jira over time is trying to go to other verticals and do other things, right? They're trying to expand to do project management for all sorts of things, not just IT, where eventually they create a project that is, or a product potentially that's too generic, right? That isn't as specialized for the niche. And, you know, where you're coming in, you're like, look, we're trying to build the very best project management software only for this one thing with all the best practices. And it's a very opinionated software, right? Your software is very opinionated to some degree about this is how you should create software and manage these projects. And as long as people buy into that, it's a perfect tool. Is that a fair statement?
Yes. I mean, just like I said in the beginning, it's not a one size fits all. It's going to, you know, like it may not be a fit for all of the teams. But what the problems we wanted to solve are, you know, tenfold, right? So the number one is multi-team, right? There are projects that are multi-team. Each team does its own process. You can't see across of them. This is the principle of agile scalability. It needs to be built in with that in mind. you know, in Jira, if you have one team and another team on the same project, they have their own individual workspaces, and you can't do product visibility. Because you can't do product visibility, people buy product tools, product boards, and et cetera solutions, because they need strategic thinking.
So in, right? So one second. So in Jira, you're really referring to them having more than one project, right?
As
more than one team?
Yeah, they have this this setting where each team is associated with one kind of project.
Yeah.
It's not a multi-team project setup.
I definitely agree. That's hard. That's hard when you've got a lot of developers and you kind of would like to have more projects, but that makes it all more siloed and isolated and harder to manage.
Exactly. And it's not easy to fix. If you've been around for 20 years, imagine how much data they have. So if you were going to refactor it to support this, you might as well write out a new product. I mean, it's a very complicated architectural solution to try to do that at the Jira level right now, 20 years later, with 80,000 customers or however they claim. So I'd probably say that this is the biggest issue in managing larger projects. But for smaller teams, you need to have no configuration. You need to have clear visibility. Hey, what are my bugs? What are my support cases? What's my backlog? And have the ability to drive a metrics-driven approach to development, right? In Jira, you have to read everything to understand where are you right now. I wanted to build a system where you don't have to read anything. You just glance at it, and there's quick indicators that you could tell if you need to take a look at something or not.
Well, you gave me a demo a few weeks ago or a few months ago when we first talked, and I was super impressed with the tool. Honestly, I was super, super impressed, but I feel like I have the same problem that a lot of other people have that you talk to. It's like, how do you then convince them to switch, right? Like, I'm still using Jira. I haven't switched. How do you, that's gotta be like the holy grail problem for you as a company is, right? Like, how do you, and you know, you gotta have enough to entice people to switch, right? The switching costs, I don't want to say the switching costs are high for this, because it's not like you're changing accounting systems or phone systems or some other things which have a much higher switching cost than this does, but it's still disruptive, right? Like, people don't want to make the change. So I'm curious, how have you figured out how to crack that? Because I feel like that is going to be one of your biggest challenges.
So very good question. And the answer is yes, absolutely. So number one, you don't actually need to switch. What you could do is you could just stop one day by using Jira for your next sprint. You can copy only the backlog items for your next sprint and just start, right?
Is there an import?
There is, but I'll talk about it a little bit later. But that's one way to start, sort of the manual way, right? So if you have a small team, you don't really care about historical data, you can do it that way and it takes no effort, right? Most of the time, the backlogs are bloated. They have things in there that they should never have.
It's the list of shit you're never going to do.
Exactly. So starting over is actually a great way to get rid of that dead weight. The other way, and it's something that we're releasing soon, is the ability to sign up and import your entire team, your entire backlog, and do the bi-directional sync.
Wow.
Yes. So again, this is maybe a news too soon, but we're coming out with it shortly. And, lots of teams have asked for it. That's why we jumped on it, number one. But we're always looking at things that will make it easier. Go ahead.
The switching part of it is the hard part, right? Like, you know, and this isn't just for you. It's for any entrepreneur that's listening, right? When you're trying to sell your product to somebody else, it's one thing to convince them that you have a better mousetrap, you built a better product, but then actually getting people to switch is really difficult because it can't just be like marginally better, right? If you call me and be like, oh, I can save you $20 a month, I'd be like, it ain't worth my effort to save the $20 a month. Like, forget that, right? Like, it's got to be a huge advantage. Like, it's got to be 10x better or something to get me to do the switch. But the easier you can make it to switch, right, then it's less risk for me to say, you know what? if all I have to do is click the import button, all my junk shows up in there, and then I can kind of play with it, and there's less risk and less time for me to make the change, then I think that dramatically reduces that, you know, barrier to get people to make the switch.
We do it even better. The next phase, once we release the import, when you bring it in, when you import all of your backlog, we will actually show you all of your team's dysfunction in the past 3 months.
Backlog,
and we'll tell you how to make it better.
I don't know if I want to see that. That sounds like Schrodinger's cat. Like, is the cat alive or dead in the box kind of thing? Like, I don't even know if I want to know.
Well, you know, to be honest, I mean, that's the power of AI, right? We got to use it. We can crunch. We can detect a lot of things. And it's awesome that way, because so far, everything that we've done, we've mostly done by human analysis, you know, even to the point of comparing cycle times, right, on tasks being completed. People will do it by hand, looking at a Jira report every sprint, but they won't compare trending, or they'll have to import it into Excel sheets. Why are we still doing it in the archaic way? I don't know.
Well, I'm honestly still excited to try this. I think there could be big value for it for my startup. I mean, obviously at Full Scale, we do work for dozens of companies. If anybody's listening, you can check us out, fullscale.io. I think it'd be, you know, really useful for all of our customers, right? Like, you know, how do we take a product like yours and recommend it to our customers if it works well for us? So I'm excited to play with it some more. There was one of the things I really liked about your product was the, I think you mentioned this was a kind of a feature sort of thing that people did in XP, which was tracking how many hours were left, like for each of the components to complete. And that was the main takeaway, I think, when you showed me the demo, that was really cool. Like if everybody at the end of the day would update, like how many hours they have left for each component, that would be really helpful to kind of, you know, every day you have this kind of built into the software of knowing where we're at, and you could assign them to all different people. That was the thing I really liked, because in Jira, it's a huge nightmare to create subtasks for all the stuff and try and track all the subtasks. I don't feel like it's very user-friendly. Where I think in your product, it was like dead simple to do.
So thank you, Matt. For anybody watching, I think Matt is referring to two things. One is called value-based stream versus work-based stream. So Jira is very work-based stream-centric, meaning you can have a backlog item, let's say a story, and if you find a bug, that's a separate backlog item that's created. And sometimes people, what they do is they decompose the story in such a way that you have a front-end story, back-end story, integration story, bug story. And that's called work-based stream, meaning you celebrate the ability of getting one of those done, but there is no value until all of those things are completed.
That's so, a pain as a project management, because I want to create like the front-end work and the back-end work and all of that crap. Like that's a pain.
That's why we created the word done, right? How do you get to done? Like it's no longer one done, it's now done, right? The value stream is sort of different. You basically combine all of the work together and break it down into tasks. And only when all the tasks are completed, the value is created. So you basically get the entire feature delivered in a section, and you're not getting credit until everything is completed. So you're really getting to the outcome versus output. And the other thing is the XP principle of time left is crucial. We're kind of opening up a Pandora box here, but the Agile community is so divided on the estimation techniques, the methodologies, the way people try to explain where they are and what's left. And, you know, there's the no estimates approach, there is the story points, there's the hour estimations, there's days. I mean, teams do a lot of different things. There is no really standard approach, but what worked for me years after years is the time left. just basically tracking where they are, because that principle, it works as an indicator when I actually know when the handoff is going to be to the next person. And the entire team does too, because the concept of in progress is non-deterministic. And that creates a whole lot of challenges with delays, with micromanagement, and it's something that we can fix.
Well, I really love that feature. And honestly, I think about it all the time because I'm thinking about with our 250 software developers that work at Fullscale, I'm like, man, should I ask all of them to do this sort of time-based every day? Like, is that a way that we could help track productivity across all of our, you know, all of our employees, at least to some, have some sense of like, what are they doing and are they making progress on those items, you know?
I wouldn't necessarily measure the productivity of it, but what I would do is I would definitely have the ability to track the handoff, right? Because if you know that somebody has just a few hours left on the task, you know they're going to get something done today. So it's a trigger
to
me.
But if they didn't, it starts to raise a red flag.
If they do not, if it's something like in progress and somebody says, hey, I'm probably going to get it done today, and they don't, you're going to find out about it in the tomorrow stand-up. So you've just burned a day for something
that
should have been simple.
My problem is I have 250 employees. I'm not in all the stand-ups, right? So that's one of the challenges I have is, you know, we ask all of our employees to do like a daily status report. So they all send a daily status report every single day. But I thought about adding that number of hours left across all of them. Like if all of them would send that to us, then maybe that could help us do some kind of reporting, but I haven't tried it yet.
I'm not really a big fan of reports. I think that's a little bit more of traditional management, right? I want teams to self-manage, and I want to give them the tools that they could see visibility across their team. Yeah. And for me, as somebody that's managing a lot of teams, what I want to do is I want to have a dashboard that I can glance to understand, are they making progress? Are they stuck? And how can I help? I don't want people to be defensive because reporting, usually people are trying to defend. And this is one of the reasons why we don't call status, right? Status is kind of a negative word. We basically say, daily stand up, right? Or something that's a little bit more versatile. But it's sort of a different management technique. That's why I'm more interested in metrics-driven development, kind of DevOps.
Right.
In DevOps, you're looking at inputs and outputs, and you're looking at, you know, different values, and you can compare and contrast. You could see what's the weakest link. You could see what are the most important things. We can actually help do that in development. And that process helps expose those challenges.
So I have in my notes here that you wrote an article about tech debt, and you said that Agile is one of the reasons we have so much tech debt.
Yes, we do. Which part was interesting for you?
Well, I didn't read the article myself. I just was in my notes here, and I was just curious what your take is on technical debt, because I think everybody's definition of technical debt, I feel like, is a little different.
So I think the problem is with just the way that people manage tech debt. Product managers generally celebrating their accomplishments by delivering features, and tech debt is the non-glamorous part of development. So a lot of times, if you're constantly going for delivering of new user-based capabilities, you're building up and accruing technical debt. What we've done with a couple teams is we've actually mapped out that the more features are being developed, the more technical debt is being created. However, the discipline for going back and closing tech debt items is something that most teams do not have. And because of that, the tech debt accrues until you reach a stalemate and you have to do something about it. So I think the agility is responsible for it in a way because of the fast pace. if you slow the pace down, and you need to have the discipline of slowing the pace down, then you can have a better control over it. But again, because the tools do not have a clear visualization, it's very easy for the tech debt items to fall down to the bottom of the backlog where nobody really cares.
Yeah, but I don't believe that in every software project that you do, that technical debt gets created as a byproduct of every sprint to release.
Depends on what you're doing, right?
I mean, I would call them technical assets, not a technical debt, right? Like, not everything is a debt. Like, unless your developers are absolutely horrible and they just create garbage every single release, right? Like, you should be building assets every release.
So, good point. This is where we have to talk about, you know, architecture a little bit, right? Do you start a project with a perfect architecture? Or do you start a project with the feature? So the way I always was taught is you build software and architecture is a byproduct of your decisions. So you build functionality and then you refactor it when you encounter that you need to cover more and more. So you get architecture in the end. You don't get architectures up front unless you're building something very, very specific where architecture is critical. And if you follow that approach, then all the time you're going to need to refactor. All the time you need to go back. And it's really the tech debt is the discipline of going back to make things the way that they should be in the perfect world. But I agree, not every technical debt needs to be repaid. Some of it you could live with, and it's up to prioritization.
So here's another analogy to something that I'm dealing with right now. So at Full Scale, and a totally different thing, and a different analogy, okay? We have 700 blog posts on fullscale.io. If you have a problem sleeping tonight, you can go to our blog and read all 700 of them. A lot of them need a lot of updates. They're not as optimized for SEO. They need updates. Are they all technical debt? Do I have to go back and rewrite all of those articles? Do I have to update them? I don't have to. I could just consider them assets and leave them alone. Or on the, you know, glass half empty side, you say, oh no, they're all technical debt. You have to go update every one of those blog posts to make them perfect, right? Like, I feel like in so much, you know, in that example, but also in a lot of software development, there's always two sides to that, right? Like, you can always look at everything kind of like glass half full of like, no, we have to go do this. We have to go improve this. We have to do that. Versus you're like, you know what? It works. Whatever. Like, and I think the answer is in the middle somewhere, right? But I feel like too many people look at it like, no, you would have to go fix all of those blog posts. We have to go fix every one of them. And I'm like, no, I don't have to.
So again, it's the problem of prioritization. If you have a challenge, you have to fix it, but you have to understand the value, right? So usually it doesn't become a tech debt just because somebody likes a better styling, for example, right?
That's no, the developers do. The developers do.
Well, they do, but
they don't think strategically about it. They're like, I just want to go fix this code. Just like my content writers are like, well, I need to go update the article so the SEO score is 80 because I want to make it be 80 out of 100.
Well, you have to review it, right? So somebody has to go in and review, hey, here's a recommendation by an engineer. Do we want to take it or not? I always tell my teams this one thing. I tell them, hey, it's not always a no. It's just not now.
Yeah. Right?
And then it may not ever become important. There were so many user stories that I once had that we were going to refactor. And then what happened is we developed something new and it became obsolete. That happens also. So I think there's a standing joke. Right? How do you tell a senior engineer from a junior engineer? You know, when a manager comes to a junior engineer, they start working on the task right away. A senior engineer waits at least a day. Why? Because things may totally change in a day. Right? So it may not be actual anymore. But I think prioritization remains one of the biggest challenges.
I love
how do you know what's of value?
Well, and so that was the argument I had with my director of marketing. Back to the content thing. I'm like, I don't want to spend a bunch of time updating these old articles that may be bad content, bad topics, bad quality, like we don't even care about this stuff anymore, versus writing new content that is really, really valuable, right? Like using this analogy, it's the same sort of struggle of like, I want to prioritize new content that's higher quality on the right topics and just kind of ignore all the old stuff that might be dead weight, right? Like I don't want to spend weeks trying to clean up the junk that it's there. It's not hurting anything. And I feel like it's a good analogy to some code. Like the code's out there, it works. Maybe it could be better. It could be in a new framework. It could be these things, but it just works. I feel like that's what a lot of technical debt is.
Well, let's think about it differently, though. Let's think about it in terms of costs, right? So imagine your marketing director can invest additional funding into writing new posts, needs to first create the content. Maybe AI can help to make it quicker and better. I don't know. Up to you how you guys do it. Then somebody needs to distribute it. Then you have to do some SEO anyway. Then you have to do some analysis. But you're doing it out of the box. You don't have no metrics to say if it's powerful or not, right? But meanwhile, yeah, you have 700 articles. So maybe you throw away the bottom performers and you don't really care about them, but you grab the sweet middle or maybe the top ones and you say, you know what? We're going to recycle these.
Yeah.
100%. We're going to take them for a spin. And what we're going to do is we just have to change it up just a little bit. Maybe something is still relevant, something is not. Here's the metrics that we have on previous campaigns. These have been generating the biggest amount of clicks. So now let's recycle them and make them even better. Right?
Yeah.
And if you do it that way, that still means that you're not throwing that away. So you're still addressing sort of tech debt. But I wouldn't call it tech debt. I would call it a next iteration, right? Because at that point, it's no longer debt. It's now you're now iterating to improve it.
Because it was an asset.
Exactly.
It was an asset. It was never debt. It was an asset that just needed some love.
Yeah, exactly. A button that didn't work right correctly, but did things incorrectly could actually be helpful.
Yeah. You know, that's the thing about software. There's no final version, right? Like it's like fashion. There's no final version. It just continues to change and evolve. And especially in most businesses, right? It's like never ending. And, you know, even at Full Scale, we have our own internal software that we've built. And, you know, I'm looking at part of it, thinking about throwing it all away and buying some other third party product. It's like, obsolete, all this like years of work out, right? And just buy some other product off the shelf. So it's like, I don't have to custom build it and support this thing anymore, you know? And that, to your joke earlier, right? It's like, it's all technical debt until you wait long enough that it's obsolete.
Yeah, the lifetime cost of ownership is very important, right? So if you're building something and you're maintaining it for your own self, well, you're going to have to keep the team. You're going to have to support it. You're going to have to, you know, manage it. You have to have somebody that's constantly thinking about it, feedback loops and all that. So yeah, it's a long-term investment, but I have a different analogy about software. It comes from my dad. My dad told me this about working on my first house when I got it. He said, Alex, you can never finish remodeling. You can only stop. Software goes the same route.
I love that. I'm going to write that down. Well, I really appreciate having you on the show today. And I think at Full Scale, I'm really excited to try your product. And I sincerely mean that. And hopefully it's something that we can recommend to our other clients. You know, we have over 50 clients that we do work with, building all sorts of software for our customers. You can check us out at fullscale.io. And your company is at projectsimple.ai, right? And this is Alex Polykov. Really, really appreciate you being on the show today. As I end the show, I always like to ask if you have any last like words of wisdom for other entrepreneurs out there.
Oh, God. Regarding what topic?
It could be anything. Maybe it's managing software projects, but anything.
Entrepreneurs. Okay. So, start small, and one step at a time, right? Don't boil the ocean. I think that's something that's probably the biggest problem for a lot of early entrepreneurs. They want to build something huge. Just start small. Start small, put it in the hands of a customers or users. You may be pleasantly surprised that they take you in the direction of pains that you've never thought about. But as soon as you can give it to the hands of the customers, you'll make a better product. I know we did, and it worked for us. We obviously have a lot of domain experience too, but you know, just try to avoid building something that has no proof. Just get proof as soon as possible and smallest steps.
Great advice. All right. Once again, this was Alex Polykov. You can check him out at projectsimple.ai. If you're building software and you want to try something better or different than Jira, definitely check them out. I was super impressed by the demo, and I sincerely mean that, and looking forward to trying it myself. So thank you so much for being on the show today, Alex.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
All right, take care.
Startup Hustle is brought to you by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Make sure you reach down and hit that subscribe button, then come find us on Instagram. See you next time. We do it.